Good evening, Raymond.
Tomas, how are you?
Not too bad. Well, there's one premiere. I see another one is in the offing here. Is that your book I see in your hand there, sir?
Breakfast in Burgundy, Tomas. It's been, six, 7 years in gestation now. I'm thrilled that it's out eventually. You know the full story, of course. You've been almost with me every step of the way. You came to visit very shortly after we bought the house in Burgundy, myself and Fionnuala. It's 8 years ago now. My horrific lack of French trips me up every now and then. I stumbled through, but I see this sign up in the village one day. It said, Votre pub ici. Your pub here. So I raced back home to Fionnuala and I said, we're getting a pub in the village, you know, fantastic. I said, let's hope it's not one of those Irish pubs, you know, which have spread like a virus around the world. And I just think this is fantastic. They'll probably knock down that old wreck of a house there and rebuild and all sorts of stuff. I wonder what it'll be like. And 2 days later, our neighbour Joël put me right. Pub, P-U-B, is short for publicité. And on an empty advertising hoarding, they will say, Votre pub here. Put your advertisement up here. And of course, you know, the minute you learn the mistake, then you start seeing these things all over the place where no pub could ever be built. Not even the most enterprising of our Celtic Tiger property developers could ever build a pub in some of the places I've seen this now.
So from one child prodigy to another then, Raymond.
Child prodigy. You're too kind. 19 years of age. Again, we've said this before, but it's worth remembering. I mean, the third violin concerto of Mozart's is possibly the best known. Maybe, you know, the fifth is still regarded as maybe the ultimate best, but in terms of just the tunefulness of it, possibly the best known. If I have the time at all, in advance of coming to the concert hall, I'll listen to a few recordings or watch a few clips on YouTube. And I came across a great one, but, you know, this sort of upset me as well, because there was this great clip of Hilary Hahn playing. And I was looking at the hall. She was playing, a great big vast hall. I was like, where is that? And the camera panned around, and right in the middle of the audience, sitting resplendent in white, was the Pope, surrounded by cardinals in scarlet and all the rest of it. I thought, oh, that's very interesting. And she's playing on, and I started scrolling down. You know, on YouTube, you get all these comments. Now, I couldn't even repeat the comments to you, Tomas. This is going to sound ridiculously naive or even prudish or priggish, but, I mean, there were comments to the effect that the musicians should put down their instruments and essentially kill the Pope.
Yes.
And I'm there saying, what? How can people... And I'm thinking, you know, this anonymity out there, as I say, it sounds very naive from me and all the rest of it, but this cloak of anonymity that allows this filth to bubble to the surface, you know, it's quite upsetting. But I scrolled back up again, back to hand playing, and by this stage she was into the second movement. And now they talk about the redemptive power of music and the rest of it. And that bad mood that had been occasioned by those comments was immediately banished by the music. And it was by the violinist herself, because in that second movement, like, she plays, the soloist plays for what, 3-4 minutes, completely solo. And if you watch, you can see the orchestra members turning almost from players into members of the audience, because they can put down their instruments. They're not waiting to come in 20 seconds' time. They can put down their instruments and they can listen. And there's almost a stripped back, austere quality to the playing there. I'm sure the musicologists will kill me for saying this, but it harked back to Bach. That sort of, I daren't say simpler stuff, but, you know, that more stripped back, leaner sort of sound. It was absolutely, and it was undoubtedly, redemptive.
Well, I have had almost exactly the same experience. I was looking around. I found the Hilary Hahn one first, of course. I was trying to figure out, that's a fine hall in Stuttgart, because it's the Stuttgart Radio Orchestra. And I was looking around, and of course it is. It's in the Vatican. It's the vile comments, absolutely vile. But you see, we're shielded from this in the classical world. We're looking at people who are, you know, looking for small gestures and comments about whether they think that music was well performed or maybe it lacked a little, you know, sort of verve. Whereas you've got this just torrent of filth underneath this playing. It was really alarming. So I, the redemptive power of music for me occurred by looking to find another performance of it. And of course, Yehudi Menuhin's performance is out there, black and white, 1967, and he is it's a rehearsal, and he's talking to the orchestra. and he's talking to the rest of the players, and he's off moving, of course, in that second, but he's taking this solo piece in the middle of it, and he's conducting at the same time, exactly what we're seeing here this evening. The soloist, who is also the conductor, but is also part of the orchestra as well. And of course, there's a lot of academic musical writing about this idea of whether these kind of concerti are really the way that we see them today, or would they have been performed in a very different fashion. We know that this was performed in Salzburg by Mozart himself, the premier, for the archbishop, whom he was having a tricky time with. And one of the things is that the opportunity to stand up out of the orchestra, strut forward, and then perform into the eyes of the Archbishop of Salzburg, do come to mind. And of course, when you're thinking with the Hilary Hahn thing, and she's performing into the eyes of the Pope, there was something, you know, resonant about that performance and this premier idea. And a lot of the academic work seems to suggest that no, that in fact the soloist, as we now see them, would have actually been sitting in with the rest of the orchestra. And really, it's more of a standing. I kind of think like a Glenn Miller moment, you know, where he nods and the trombonists stand up and do their piece. And it was probably more like that that these things were originally performed than the way we see them now, which is as a fantastic vehicle for a virtuoso.
Exactly. They talk about HIP, historically informed performance, and it's the sort of stripped back. We should go back to the original instruments, the period instruments. If you go back, say, to the time of Bach, they'd be talking about gut strings, no vibrato, all that sort of thing. There's this constant tension between whether music should be played like that, or whether the ornamentation that has come in through the 19th century and into the 20th century, is that a valid add-on or not? Should it be the way the composer would have heard it? I'm not sure, but it does sort of tend to polarise the musical world, and there's constant debate between, you know, the sort of the Baroque way of playing and the more modern Romantic way of playing.
Well, I think, you know, this is why we put Shakespeare and Mozart and Beethoven and Goethe into the same sort of milieu, because the reason they're so important is that they can, you know, they last, and they are reinterpreted by each generation for each generation. I think, you know, I've seen authentic reproductions of how Shakespeare would have been played, you know, and I find them slightly tedious.
Yeah. And you've probably also seen ones in modern dress and that sort of thing, which are equally valid interpretations. And I suppose you can say the same
exactly
about the music.
Yeah, so I think that's, you know, it's a totally valid, to see the performances we've seen it here tonight, totally valid and in fact exciting.
And with a man like Julian Racklin playing, he's had a busy week. He's had a busy week here since we were last here. He's had the studio concert. He's been working with the chamber orchestra in the Royal Irish Academy. So he's had a busy week, and he's finishing up here now. Wonderful playing there with the Mozart. And what about the Liszt, Tomás? I know that's a favourite piece of yours.
I have been, I've been strangely obsessed by...
You're always strangely obsessed, Tomás.
Yes, well, I'm particularly obsessed with Sergei Dresden, of course. All you have to do for me is show him hugging Yoko Ono, and I'm there. On his Facebook, yes, he has a Facebook. I was wondering, you know, 19-year-old Mozart, he'd have definitely had a Facebook, wouldn't he?
Yeah, and Twitter.
Oh, Twitter and Facebook.
LinkedIn?
Instagram.
Maybe not.
I don't know, probably not LinkedIn. No, that would be too
professional.
Well, actually, he was such a networker, he probably would have been a LinkedIn kind of guy. And his Facebook is an astonishing resource, let me tell you. It tells you quite a lot about him. The things that he's foregrounding, last week he spent quite a bit of time looking at the Russian Winnie the Pooh, whom he thinks is far superior to the Disney Winnie the Pooh, which I'd have to agree with. I think almost anything is far superior to the Disney Winnie the Pooh. You know, the shepherd Winnie the Pooh is really the, you know, your the locus classicus of Pooh.
Well, I'm definitely going to get another drink.
Okay, hold on. You go and get that. So he
keep
is...
Keep talking while I'm away.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, Tomás, following on from what you just said there about this is an arrangement of Liszt, and you're sort of saying it should almost be his piece inspired by Liszt. I think it might be a bit like a few weeks ago here in the concert hall, they had the Rachmaninoff variations on a theme of Paganini. Of course, now this is it's violin to piano rather than piano to violin. And that piece is, well, it's typically known as Rackpag amongst the musical community. So they almost stand equally there, whereas he's here in brackets, in parentheses tonight.
Yes.
And you're suggesting, and having listened to it, I mightn't have believed you until I listened to it, having listened to it, there's originality there, which would, I think, would demand that he's given equal billing, you might say. Dresden, that
so
is.
So we want to start the campaign for the removal of those brackets.
Yeah. Unshackle him.
Unshackle him.
Second movements, Tomás. This is my theme for the evening. Second movements. Now, I know you tried to put me to sleep there with the Winnie the Pooh stuff, and I'm going to do the same to you now, because I'm going to tell you a story you've heard many times before. You'll feel your eyes getting heavy. Don't resist. The seventh symphony is the Damascene piece of work for me. Age of 14, discovered the Herbert von Karajan recording of it. Haven't looked back since. But if one single piece did it, it was the second movement, that celebrated second movement, which is quite an extraordinary piece of work. I think mistakes can often be made with regard to it, though. I mean, I've listened to loads of different recordings of it over the years, over many years. The slow movement is obviously the slow movement, but it's the slow movement relative to the other movements. And sometimes I think a mistake is made where it's played too slowly and it becomes just funereal and almost feels like, you know, almost a dying gasp. It's running out of steam. I think it should be somber and solemn, but it should have life in it. There should be a pulse pushing it forward the whole time there. And if it loses that, it just becomes dirge-like. It loses that vivacity. As I say, you know, once it's over and you go into the third movement, you can say, oh, wow, yeah, this, then it's back into fireworks and all the rest of it. But that gorgeous slow movement, and they repeated it on the night, on the premiere. You were talking about premieres. Beethoven himself was conducting. At that stage, he was pretty deaf, and typically the leader of the orchestra had to do a lot of work, and he was waving his arms about, but maybe not contributing a huge amount. But hell, he'd written the piece, so why not indulge him? And they immediately called for an encore straight away. It was put into publication. There was arrangements done for all sorts of things. It just became instantly overnight hit.
Ladies and gentlemen, our doors will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium. Our doors will close in 5 minutes.
I've always wondered, how do you get an encore for a specific movement in a symphony?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, because I don't know either. But I went one time to the opera festival in Verona. Now, it's real mainstream stuff. It's in the old Roman arena there. It's absolutely magnificent. And on the opening night, they all light the candle, and there's a plane might fly overhead. It's absolutely fantastic. But it was the Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves. And the conductor finished it, and before the audience could clap and call for an encore, they just did it again. Just like that, instantly. It was fantastic, brilliant experience. And then they all clapped and we went on with the opera. So it was just like he put it on a loop for 5 minutes and then moved on forward again.
Well, now, so I'm just thinking, like, what's the signal you'll give me for us to jump up? They finished the second movement and we want shout, do it again, one more time, Starry Night, again.
When you jump up, I will rugby tackle you to the ground, okay?
Obviously, we've spoken many times about this glorious night, this premiere, and the more I find out about it, the weirder it becomes. It was such a weird evening. I mean, did you hear about Johann Nepomuk Maisel? This man appeared to be some kind of inventor, and in fact his connection to Beethoven is he's the man that invented the famous horn that went into his ear. And and he made trumpets, and he also made mechanical automata. That was a big part of his gig. And at this premiere, one of the things that was going on was there was a mechanical performance. So he'd invented a whole automatous orchestra, and that was performing a couple of small pieces in the middle of this as well. Now, also being performed that night, of course, is the Victory of Wellington. So that piece, but it was being performed in its original format, where Beethoven was going for stereophonic brilliance and had half the orchestra on the left-hand side, half the orchestra on the right-hand side, and then they fire shots of music across at each other. So there'll be a blast of violin from one side, then a blast of violin from the other. This is musket fire going back and forth. So you think, well, that's not too bad, except until, of course, you decide that you're also going to throw in real musket fire, and real guns. And so half a dozen guns, little cannons, were brought in on either side and fired across the hall as well. Now, through the smoke, the noise and the haze, they lash into the Seventh Symphony. And I don't know, you know, who was deafer at that point in time, Beethoven or the audience. And we have descriptions of him going nuts, particularly in the final movement as well. So I have this thing. You've got mechanical automata, we've got guns, gun smoke, fire, shouting. It's just unbelievable. And of course, as we are always saying, it lasted a good 4.5 hours. You got your money's worth as well.
And do you think they'll have them here tonight, all these guns and the rest of it?
I'm very much hoping so. But then in the middle of all this, they go and do the second movement again. So I just think, marvellous.
Superb.
Marvellous. But it's a brilliant piece. I also like to contrast, if we're thinking now, when we're listening to the end of this, I love a dramatic ending. And that's why I was always a little bit disappointed with Mozart number 3. It just...
It fades away.
It fades away.
It fades away.
You've got the wind come in and just, you know, parp.
Yep.
Right.
Well, this doesn't fade away.
No.
Absolutely not. You know, the critical reaction to it, Tomás, was very mixed. I mean, one fellow suggested that it was written by a drunkard. And much more recently, Thomas Beecham said something like one of the movements was like a bunch of yaks jumping about.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. Like yaks jumping up and down.
I think it was the Brilliant. Third movement. But notwithstanding that, Tomás, if a genie came out of a bottle here now and said, Raymond, you can choose one great piece of classical music that you composed, it would be the Seventh Symphony of Beethoven.
Well, the second movement of the Seventh Symphony is the one I'd choose. And, of course, that's what people were doing. And I keep thinking of it as a fantastically interesting thing, is that they excise that second movement. And we have plenty of records that they used to drop it into many of his symphonies if they were getting a little slack, you know. And they'd throw in the second movement just to remind you, hey, remember this. And it's kind of like, you know...
He also wrote this.
He also wrote this. I was thinking, you know, and I'm sure Johnny Logan doesn't have this problem, but you could always... As long as, no matter how the concert is going, throw in What's Another Year and it'll always end on a high note.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final call, ladies and gentlemen.